content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward with the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the April 21st, 2023 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week shows U.S. District Court Judge Matthew Kaczmarek. He's dressed like Moses. There's the mountain in the background, storm and lightning. He's holding a staff in his right hand with his finger pointing towards the viewer. In his left hand is a stone tablet. And it says on it, "Thou shalt not." And below that is a picture of a bottle of mifepristone. The headline is, "A Judge's Holy War. Will Kaczmarek's ruling to ban abortion pills be overturned?" That is our first main story. We'll start there. Judge reverses FDA approval of abortion bill. What happened? A legal battle over medication abortion appeared to be headed for the Supreme Court this week after a conservative federal judge in Texas ruled that the Food and Drug Administration must reverse its approval of mifepristone, an abortion pill that's been in wide use for 23 years. U.S. District Judge Matthew Kaczmarek, a Trump appointee, said the FDA overlooked legitimate safety concerns when it approved the pill, part of a two-drug regimen used in more than half of U.S. abortions. The ruling marks the first time a judge has revoked FDA approval of a specific medication and contradicts more than 100 scientific studies and two decades of use that support the FDA's finding that mifepristone is very safe. Kaczmarek said the FDA failed to consider the drug's psychological effects, writing that women who undergo abortions often experience shame, regret, anxiety, depression, drug abuse, and suicidal thoughts. A former attorney for a conservative Christian group who has expressed strong personal opposition to abortion, Kaczmarek relied on language from the anti-abortion movement throughout the 67-page ruling, referring to doctors who perform abortions as abortionists and to a fetus as an unborn human or unborn child. He said the term fetus was unscientific. Shortly after Kaczmarek issued his ruling, a federal judge in Washington state issued a conflicting ruling in a separate case. Siding with 18 attorneys general in Democratic states, Judge Thomas O. Rice affirmed that the FDA's approval of mifepristone was lawful and valid, and blocked the agency from taking any action to reduce its availability in those 18 states. The conflicting rulings and an appeal of the Texas ruling filed by the Department of Justice means the matter of mifepristone is highly likely to land before the Supreme Court before long. More than 400 leaders of top pharmaceutical and biotech firms signed a letter denouncing Kaczmarek's ruling as judicial activism and calling for its reversal. Republican lawmakers were largely silent on the matter, while some Democrats urged the FDA to ignore the judge's order. "This ruling is not about science," said Senator Patty Murray of Washington. "It's about ideology." What the editorial said. "Kaczmarek's ruling is a travesty," said the Los Angeles Times. He ignored 23 years of safe usage of mifepristone and research that's deemed it safer than Tylenol, antibiotics, and Viagra, and far safer than pregnancy itself. But this suit was never about women's safety. That's just a ploy by activists bent on denying pregnant people the right to health care and the ability to control their own bodies. These anti-abortion zealots went shopping for a far-right activist judge who delivered the result they wanted. In his imprudent ruling, Kaczmarek made several legal leaps, said the Wall Street Journal. He blows past the plaintiff's failure to show they've suffered injury from the FDA's actions, a requirement for bringing suit. He ignores a six-year statute of limitations to challenge FDA actions, making the dubious claim that the agency reopened the window when it eased some regulations and dispensing mifepristone in 2021. Second-guessing the FDA and regulating drugs isn't the business of the courts any more than abortion is. What the columnist said. Kaczmarek's ruling will go down in history as one of the judiciary's most shocking and lawless moments, said Mark Joseph Stern in Slate. The rogue judge seems to have largely copied and pasted materials and studies supplied by the plaintiffs, while pretending it's legal analysis. The ruling reads like a screed penned by an anti-abortion activist, because it largely is. Banning mifepristone isn't about safety, it's about power, said Anita Shabria in the Los Angeles Times. It's about stripping away privacy and abortions and forcing women into public where they can be policed and controlled. 13 states now ban abortion, and two more have near bans. Medical abortions are a lifeline for women in these states who often have no other recourse, even in cases of rape or incest. If the ruling is allowed to stand, its effects will be profound and wide-reaching, said Elizabeth Nolan Brown in Reason. It represents an unprecedented situation in which a single judge could upend FDA approval of a medication that's been safely in use for decades. Setting that precedent could wreak havoc on the entire system of drug and vaccine approvals in the U.S. and invite an avalanche of legal challenges to other controversial drugs. That's one reason the Supreme Court may well overturn the ruling, said Matt Ford in the New Republic. Judges have typically recognized that the FDA is better suited than they are to decide which drugs are safe. Add that concern to the ruling's problems with standing and the statute of limitations, and a reversal would not be surprising. We'll go right into a second main story. After national uproar, ousted Tennessee Democrats return. What happened? Two black Democratic Tennessee state legislators returned triumphantly to office this week after their expulsion by the Republican supermajority provoked a national outcry and drew condemnation from civil rights leaders. Local officials in both districts unanimously voted to reappoint Representatives Justin Jones, representing Nashville, and Representative Justin J. Pearson, representing a district in Memphis, to their seats in the Tennessee House of Representatives. The two men, along with Democratic Representative Gloria Johnson of Knoxville, faced an expulsion vote last week after they joined protesters who had taken over the House chamber to call for stricter gun laws in the wake of the recent mass shooting at a Nashville elementary school. The Republican-dominated state legislature expelled Jones and Pearson, but not Johnson, a 60-year-old white woman who said it was very apparent that race was a factor in her more lenient treatment. The Tennessee 3 case made headlines around the world, throwing a spotlight on racial tensions in the state. A state in which the Ku Klux Klan was founded is now attempting another power grab by silencing the two youngest black representatives and one of the only Democratic women in this body, said Jones. That's what this is about. President Biden called the expulsions shocking, undemocratic, and without precedent, while Vice President Kamala Harris attended a rally for the lawmakers in Nashville ahead of their reinstatement. Pearson and Jones will retain their seats until special elections are held to fill the vacancies, and both are expected to win. But Democrats said Republican legislators are now threatening to retaliate against the local councils that reinstated the two men by withholding funds for public schools in those districts. what the editorial said. The Tennessee Three did breach house rules by joining the protesters and speaking out of turn, said the Los Angeles Times. But ousting Jones and Pearson and disenfranchising their 130,000 constituents is wildly out of proportion to the conduct. Expulsion is usually rare, reserved for criminal activity, but Jones and Pearson were simply voicing their constituents' frustration at Republicans' refusal to consider the most modest of controls on firearms. Their speeches were hardly a January 6-like assault. Democrats would have us believe that it's okay to disrupt Democratic proceedings if it's for one of their preferred causes, said National Review, and that Johnson was not expelled because she's white. In fact, it was because she, unlike Jones and Pearson, did not use a megaphone to lead the crowd in chants. Republicans were right to sanction these rabble-rousers in some way. It's just unfortunate that they chose expulsion, which only created martyrs. What the columnist said. Free speech rights are supposed to foster, not block, the free exchange of ideas, said Quinn Hillier in the Washington Examiner. Tennessee's legislature was in the middle of considering a bill when protesters stormed the chamber. The Democratic lawmakers then commandeered the speaker's well and helped the protesters shut down the meeting for 45 minutes. Stifling debate like that negates the very point of the First Amendment. Our state legislature's petty and retaliatory leadership suppresses free speech all the time, said Pam Saun in the Chattanooga Times Free Press. Speaker Cameron Sexton has done everything he can to muzzle the few Democrats in the legislature from refusing to call on them to even switching off their microphones. This time, the Tennessee Three kept talking. The GOP's expulsion of these two men wasn't about decorum, said Charles Blow in the New York Times. It was about race. Tennessee Republicans wanted to dominate and politically neuter representatives of the minority party and the state's black population. We've seen the same thing in Mississippi, Missouri, and other red states, where Republican state legislatures have acted to strip Democratic majority black cities of self-governance. The whole episode shows just how far Republicans are willing to go to hold power, even to the extent of nullifying the votes of black and brown voters, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Republican policies on guns, abortion, voting rights, and other issues are highly unpopular. So GOP state legislatures are launching an asymmetrical civil war against democracy. With the 2024 election approaching, this could be the country's most perilous moment since the prelude to our Civil War. Controversy of the week. Justice Thomas, a billionaire buddy's secret gifts. Clarence Thomas was already the most plainly corrupt Supreme Court justice since, well, maybe since ever, said Michael Tomasky in The New Republic. Now comes ProPublica's bombshell report detailing how, for two decades, the far-right justice secretly accepted luxury travel and accommodations worth millions of dollars from conservative mega-donor Harlan Crow, a billionaire real estate mogul. Thomas and wife Jenny, a keen if peripheral player in President Trump's plot to steal the 2020 election, have been regular passengers on Crow's private Bombardier jet. As guests on his fully staffed 162-foot-long, fully crewed yacht, they've toured New Zealand and the islands of Indonesia. They summer every year at Crow's estate in the Adirondacks, where there hangs an oil painting of Crow and Thomas smoking cigars with former Federalist Society head Leonard Leo and other right-wing power brokers. In response to the revelations, Thomas claimed this week that unspecified colleagues had advised him that personal hospitality from close personal friends didn't need to be reported on financial disclosure forms, said Dahlia Lithwick in Slate. But he clearly violated federal ethics laws. The greater scandal is that because of Thomas' political clout among Republicans, it probably won't matter. Sorry, liberals, but Supreme Court justices are allowed to have friends, said Scott Gerber in The Hill. Never in the 25 years of his friendship with Thomas did Crow have business before the court. And as a matter of semantics, the term hospitality does encompass yachts and jets when the host is a billionaire. The left's goal is smearing Thomas is obvious, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Liberals want to delegitimize a court they no longer control and would love to remove Thomas through impeachment so Democrats can fill his seat. Instituting a new code of conduct for the court, as Senate Judiciary Chairman Dick Durbin called for this week, is designed to harass Thomas and other conservative justices into recusal from critical cases. How is it a smear to report on true things public officials are doing? Asked Ely Mistel in The Nation. Crow, Leo, and other right-wing activists hobnobbing with Thomas didn't need to bribe him for his already-in-the-bag vote, but their chummy access gave them a chance to seed Thomas with the extremist conservative arguments on abortion, the Second Amendment, and business regulations that have filled his opinions. In a fawning documentary Crow financed, Thomas ironically claimed he prefers to vacation with regular stock in RV parks and Walmart parking lots. In the real world, the ordinary people adversely affected by Thomas' rulings weren't invited to smoke cigars with the boys or to inspect Crow's collection of Nazi memorabilia and Hitler souvenirs. Thomas has always been an ethical disaster, said Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine. In 2011, he failed to disclose Jenny's $680,000 income from conservative groups. Last year, he cast the court's sole vote to keep her insurrectionist text from the House January 6 committee. His rewarding friendship with Crow is more proof of his open contempt for the idea any ethical obligations might constrain his power. Let's face it, said Jamel Bowie in the New York Times, the Supreme Court is not going to police itself. Congress needs to impose an enforceable code of ethics on the court. If the justices we entrust with awesome, unreviewable power won't do the right thing in the spirit of public service, then we should make them. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for ancient scrolls. After John Rahm, who won last week's Masters Tournament, revealed he posted on Twitter back in 2013 that he was gonna win the Masters. That prophetic tweet included a photo of a Chinese cookie fortune that reads, "Your talents will be recognized and suitably rewarded." It was a good week for 12-year-old boys after Elon Musk, a big fan of breast jokes, painted over the W in the sign outside Twitter's San Francisco headquarters so that it now reads at Titter. And it was a good week for the porn industry with revelations that Claudia, an attractive 19-year-old brunette who's selling lots of new photos of herself on the website Reddit, is the imaginary creation of an AI-powered image generator. But it was a bad week for Big Brother. After Llano County, Texas, officials responded to a judge's order that they restore banned books from the public library by threatening to shut down the library altogether. It was a bad week for biting off your own nose after a New Jersey man videoed his destruction of an extensive collection of Jack Daniel's bottles and merchandise in protest of the woke-ass company's announced support for LGBTQ rights. "You will never have the honor of touching my lips ever again," shouted Pauly Michaelis, age 50. Finally, it was a bad week for audience participation after a performance of The Bodyguard in Manchester, England, ended in a mini-riot because some audience members refused, please, to stop singing the climatic Whitney Houston song, "I Will Always Love You." Turning to the briefing page, we have turning bodies into soil. As cemeteries run short on space, some people are turning to human composting to dispose of their remains. What is human composting? It's an environmentally friendly way of burying people in which human remains are turned into rich soil, also known as natural organic reduction. The process takes roughly 2 months to decompose a body, producing soil which loved ones might use to plant flowers, vegetables, or trees. In 2019, Washington became the first state to allow human composting, and hundreds of people have chosen this means of disposing of their remains. Oregon, Colorado, Vermont, and New York followed with their own legalization. California plans to allow human composting by 2027. As urban cemeteries around the world near capacity, cremation rates have soared. But many people concerned about climate change and the environment don't want their incinerated remains to release hundreds of pounds of carbon dioxide and toxic chemicals. A 2022 survey by the National Funeral Directors Association found that 60% of Americans are open to green end-of-life arrangements. Is burial still commonplace? Not nearly to the extent it was just a few decades ago. In 2021, just 37% of Americans were buried, compared with roughly 90% in 1980. Many observant Christians, Jews, and Muslims still wish to be buried, in keeping with tradition and religious teachings. But for many people, burial is growing less and less practical. A casket burial costs about $8,000 on average, and a burial plot can cost thousands of dollars more. In crowded urban areas like New York City, a plot can cost up to $1 million. Cities are running out of cemetery space, forcing people to be buried hours away from where they lived. Acute cemetery plot shortages are occurring in crowded areas throughout the world, as available land can't keep pace with the number of people dying every day. What about cremation? It's increasingly popular, usually costing $1,000 to $2,500, but incinerating a body uses enough fuel to fill a SUV's gas tank, and total cremations in the U.S. release about 360,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide every year. During the pandemic, Los Angeles was forced to suspend air pollution rules because of the surging demand for cremating COVID victims. Cremations also released carbon monoxide and sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere, plus vaporized mercury from tooth fillings, accounting for about 16% of total mercury emissions, according to the United Nations. How are bodies composted? A corpse is dressed in a biodegradable gown, typically made of cotton, and placed in a reusable closed steel cylinder that's packed with biodegradable materials such as wood chips, alfalfa, and straw. At some facilities, loved ones can surround the body with flowers, notes, or other sentimental items. Air is pumped into the closed vessel, and microbes degrade the body and cause the vessel to get hot, with vents filtering the resulting gases. There are billions of microbial living things in our digestive tracts, said Seth Bedall, who co-owns a human composting center in Colorado. When our one life ceases, the life of those microbes does not cease. After about a month, workers sift out medical implants such as pacemakers and hip replacements and pulverize the remaining bones. The remaining soil is left for another few weeks to settle. Then it can be donated or returned in sacks to families who can place it where they see fit. Are there obstacles? Yes, the Catholic Church has said that composting treats human remains as a disposable commodity, arguing that it's more appropriate for vegetable trimmings and eggshells than for human bodies. Other Christian, Jewish, and Muslim denominations have also expressed opposition. There are philosophical and emotional objections as well. For decades, the funeral industry has promoted the idea that expensive burials can protect loved ones from decomposition through embalming, sealed caskets, and even concrete vaults. Composting is a challenge to this concept and embraces dust to dust on an accelerated timeline. It costs more than twice as much as cremation, ranging from $5,000 to $7,000, about the same as burial. Availability is also an issue. For now, at least, U.S. human composting centers don't have close to the capacity to process a significant number of bodies. What are the advantages? The impact on the environment is dramatically lessened. Every year, U.S. casket burials use 30 million board feet of wood and nearly 2 million tons of concrete, steel, and other materials. They introduce 5.3 million gallons of embalming fluids, such as formaldehyde, methanol, and ethanol, into the earth each year. People who choose composting and other green alternatives, such as burial without a coffin, say they like the idea of returning to nature after they die. I've always wanted to be a tree, said Democratic State Representative Christina Garcia, 45, who sponsored California's bill legalizing human composting. The idea of having my family sitting under my shade one day, that brings a lot of joy. And we're into a few of the best columns of the week, starting with the growing number of child deaths. Average life expectancy is one of the most fundamentally revealing facts about a country, said Davis Wallace Wells. And in the U.S., this critical measure is moving not forward but backward at unprecedented speed. New data reveals that the dramatic decline in U.S. life expectancy, which breaks from all global and historical patterns, is being driven primarily not by well-publicized deaths of despair among the middle-aged or even by COVID, but by deaths of children and teenagers. Today, in the average American kindergarten, at least one child can expect to be buried by his or her parents. Overall, Americans are dying younger than in any peer countries, including China, Cuba, and Lebanon. Why? The U.S. is a violent place and is getting more violent. Gun homicides and suicides account for nearly half of the increase in youth mortality, with these deaths concentrated among males and black people. Car crashes, accidental drug overdoses, and poisonings also take a grim toll on the young. This exceptionalism of violence extends into early adulthood, with Americans between 25 and 34 being more than twice as likely to die as their peers in Japan and Britain. This is a deeply troubled country. A Democrat's puzzling defection. When Tricia Cottom won a seat in the North Carolina State House last year, said Ed Kilgore, she campaigned on a platform of raising the minimum wage to $15, protecting abortion and voting rights, and strengthening LGBTQ rights. Yet last week, Cottom shocked the state and enraged Democrats by announcing she was becoming a Republican. Her switch to the GOP, gives the GOP a veto-proof supermajority in the state legislature and enables them to override vetoes by Democratic Governor Roy Cooper. Her relationship with Democrats soured only a few weeks ago when she was criticized for missing a vote that allowed Republicans to override Cooper's veto on a pistol permit repeal. Cottom says she was then bullied by liberals online for her choice to include American flag and prayer hand emojis on her social media platforms. Given that she represents a Democratic stronghold district that preferred Joe Biden by 23 points in 2020, spite seems like a weak reason for her to join the GOP and essentially doom her re-election chances next year. Will state Republicans really embrace a lawmaker who has spoken publicly of her own abortion and co-sponsored a bill codifying the right to choose? For now, we will have to keep guessing. This column comes from the Philippines. Holy Week is in decline. Amen to that. The decline of the Catholic Church is a watershed moment for the Philippines, said Rigoberto Tiglao. Catholicism's culture and worldview have dominated this country since the Spanish conquistadors subjugated this archipelago nearly 500 years ago. Yet it is now falling out of favor. Churches are nearly empty on Sundays, while even on Easter weekend, malls, movie theaters, and golf courses are full. It's partly the pandemic. Lockdowns broke the habit of Sunday Mass, while the disease itself led some to wonder. Saint and sinners, the virus didn't differentiate. So what's the use of religion? The decline is also a legacy of former President Rodrigo Duterte, who openly challenged the power of the church in ways that few Filipino politicians had before, telling church leaders, "You are in palaces while your faithful are in squatter areas, and then you talk about sanctity?" Questioning the beliefs developed since childhood is not for the faint of heart, but it comes with its own rewards that don't wait for heavens. There's no going back from this more secular place. The problem now is how to raise our children and grandchildren in this new world, for them to be able to find meaning and moral compass without heavens and hells, without a holy week. And it's time for the last word. Headline this week, King of the Autograph Hunters. Radio man stands above every other grapher on earth, said Drew Schwartz in the New York Times. His secret? Start with rescuing Amal Clooney and teaching Robin Williams to play a bum. On a blustery February evening in Midtown Manhattan, opposite an unmarked side entrance to the Ed Sullivan Theater, a crowd of more than 60 people stood crushed against a row of steel barricades. They all knew that at any moment, Harrison Ford would arrive for an appearance on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. They elbowed and cursed one another, jockeying for position, each clutching a sheaf of photographs for Ford to sign. They weren't fans, not most of them, anyway. They were graphers who make a living by hounding celebrities for autographs and selling them to the highest bidder. For many of them, graphing is a full-time job. Some have been at it for decades. They can flip a single signature for anywhere from $25 to more than $1,000, depending on a star's cachet and how frequently they sign. A Harrison Ford autograph, for example, retails for about $750. At 5:30 on the dot, a black Escalade pulls to a stop in front of the theater. The rear door swung open, and the pack of graphers across the street broke into a frenzy. "Harrison," they hollered. "Harrison, please." Slumped near a dumpster by the stage door, a disheveled man with a mane of gray hair and a wild beard let out a grunt. He clambered to his feet, reached into a grocery bag, and pulled out an overstuffed FedEx mailer inscribed in large looping cursive with a note. "Thank you, Harrison," it read. "Love, Radio Man." He staggered past the theater security team and approached the Escalade. "Harrison," the man called as Ford climbed out of the back seat. "How are you?" Ford grinned. "Radio," he said warmly. They shook hands. 50 feet away, the graphers behind the barricades bellowed a desperate chorus. "Listen, I've got some photos for you," the man said, handing Ford the package. "Sure, sure," Ford said, accepting it. They made small talk. Ford asked after the man's health, and the man asked after Helen Mirren, Ford's co-star on the Yellowstone spinoff, 1923. "Good to see you, Radio," Ford said. He slipped into the theater without acknowledging the graphers screaming his name. They would have to wait until he finished his interview. There are probably at least 500 professional graphers in the world, according to Justin Steffman, founder of the autograph authentication company Autograph COA, and at least 150 of them are in New York, the world capital of the trade. And right now, they are working at full tilt. All winter long, celebrities have been flocking to New York to campaign for projects up for various film and television awards, culminating in the Oscars. For graphers, collecting signatures during award season is like fishing at a trout farm. But none of them do it quite like Radio Man. Radio Man, legally known as Craig Castaldo, though no one ever calls him that, has been graphing in New York since the early 1990s. Over the years, he has managed to charm a small army of celebrities into accepting his hefty packages of photographs, which they sign and return to him. Where most graphers would be lucky to get more than one signature from a star at a time, Radio Man regularly nabs dozens, sometimes hundreds. He considers the A-listers who sign for him his personal friends. After his exchange with Ford, Radio Man made his way to the Park Hyatt to pick up a package that Sarah Michelle Gellar had left for him at a reception. It was adorned with a heart and black Sharpie, along with a handwritten note. "Only for you, Radio." Inside were 43 signed photographs of Gellar. "It's amazing how they took to me, these actors," Radio Man said. "A bum. I don't understand it." Radio Man, 72, lives just above the poverty line in a basement apartment in Yonkers he rents for $900 a month. He commutes into the city each morning on his bicycle, a 13-mile journey that takes him about 2 hours. He said he survives exclusively on food he gathers from free pantries and movie sets. Though he could make a small fortune selling his autographs directly to collectors, his grasp of the necessary tools, photo databases, printers, the internet, is tenuous at best. Instead, like most graphers, he peddles his merchandise to a dealer, who in turn hawks it at a significant markup on eBay and other more obscure autograph marketplaces. Leaning against a wall outside the Park Hyatt, Radio Man pulled out his phone and made a call. A few minutes later, a silver sedan pulled up to the hotel. A tall, middle-aged man with close-cropped hair and a manicured beard stepped out of the car and into the frigid night. Radio Man handed him a package of signed photographs from Gellar, and the man accepted them without a word. He hurried back to the warmth of his car, leaving Radio Man alone next to his bicycle. "Hey," Radio Man called out to him, "you got $6 so I could get a tea or something?" "I don't have any cash on me," the man said. He ducked into the car and drove away. The man, radio man's de facto handler, supplies him with his FedEx mailers of photographs. Once radio man gets them signed, the handler sends them to a dealer based in Florida, who is rumored among graphers to be a millionaire. All told, the autographs radio man received from Galar are worth approximately $6,000. He was paid about $300 for them. Let them make all the money they want, radio man said. I don't care. As long as I get to see my friends. By friends, he meant the celebrities who have taken an unlikely shine to him since he stumbled into their world more than 30 years ago. As radio man tells it, he made his first famous friend when he was homeless. One winter day in 1990, he was walking through Central Park when he encountered a man dressed in rags, whom he took for a bum like me, he said. He offered the man a beer. Do you know who I am? The man asked. It was Robin Williams. He was shooting The Fisher King, Terry Gilliam's 1991 film in which Williams plays a vagabond searching for the Holy Grail. You're doing this all wrong, radio man told him. You're not acting the way a bum should be. He introduced the actor to life on the street, showing him where to go and what to do. Williams patterned his performance in The Fisher King, which earned him an Oscar nomination, after Radio Man, or so Radio Man claims. In exchange for his guidance, the movie's producers gave Radio Man $200 and a case of beer. They also cast him as an extra. From then on, he made a habit of hanging around film sets in New York, where he helped himself to food from craft service stations and scored low-paying parts as a background actor. Graphing was an easy way to make money. I've been getting movies ever since, Radio Man said. Here and there, playing my role. Bum, homeless guy, guy on a bicycle with a radio. But that's just one version of the story Radio Man tells about his origins. Another version involves running a newspaper stand in the 1970s and being cast as an extra in The In-Laws, starring Peter Falk and Alan Arkin. Another involves sharing a beer with Bruce Willis on the set of The Bonfire of the Vanities. Yet another involves showing up to shoots with a boombox around his neck and playing it at full volume until someone paid him to leave, a racket that supposedly earned him his nickname. A cop was there and he said to me, "Hey, radio guy. Hey, radio person. Hey, radio man. Can you turn that down, please?" And that's how I became Radio Man. Radio Man is a fixture on film sets in New York. He has appeared as an extra in dozens of movies, including Ransom, Zoolander, The Departed, and The Irishman. He has a preternatural knowledge of actors' whereabouts and shooting schedules, and he has forged something like a friendship with some of the biggest names in Hollywood. On a January night in Chinatown, Radio Man sauntered around the set of Wolves, a forthcoming movie starring George Clooney and Brad Pitt, as if he were its executive producer. He weaved through packs of stagehands, chanting amiably with anyone who crossed his path. During a break in shooting, he shuffled over to Clooney, who was sitting in the director's chair. "Clooney," he shouted, followed by an expletive-laden insult. "There it is," Clooney said. "You know where you're going tomorrow?" "I don't know where I'm going tomorrow," Clooney said. "Under the Manhattan Bridge." "See, this is what I'm talking about," Clooney said, as the production crew standing around him laughed. "You don't need a call sheet. Radio Man is the call sheet." Clooney first met Radio Man in 1996 on the set of One Fine Day in Manhattan. "The actor has never not seen him during a trip to New York since," he said. "Radio's everywhere," Clooney said. "Every hotel you show up at, radio will be standing out front of it going, 'De Niro's over at this, and Kate Blanchett's over here staying at the Carlisle's.' He's got all the intel." Radio Man endeared himself to Clooney, the actor said, after rescuing his wife, Amal Clooney, from a throng of paparazzi that had swarmed her on Fifth Avenue. Radio man blocked them with his bicycle, hailed a cab, and steered Amal Clooney inside, securing her escape. "He's a great guy," George Clooney said. "He's a lovable mess, which we all are." About 6 years ago, Clooney got together with a few other actors and flew Radio Man out to L.A. They sent him to the Oscars. He wore a tuxedo. He walked the red carpet. He sat in the audience. He brought a date. A few nights after bumping into Radio Man in Chinatown, Clooney poked his head out of a white trailer parked on East Broadway and peered down the street. "Radio," he yelled. Radio Man ambled over. Clooney strode toward him, holding a large bag, trailed by a pack of photographs. "Here you go, Radio," he said, dropping the bag on the sidewalk with a thunk. "This thing weighs a ton, by the way." Radio Man reached inside and pulled out two bulging FedEx mailers. They contained 185 signed photographs of Clooney, worth approximately $18,000. Clooney said that Radio Man is the only grapher he will take a package from, but he signs for all of them. "Every one of these guys who come over for autographs, it's a business for them," he said. "You try to help them out when you can." Back on the set of Wolves, Radio Man cruised the streets of Chinatown looking for director John Watts. He was hoping there might be a scene he could sneak into, but the cameras were already rolling and Watts was occupied. Radio Man returned to his usual post outside Clooney's trailer. It was closing in on midnight. He was standing near his bicycle and sipping a hot tea, killing time until the next break in filming, when he was approached by someone he didn't recognize. "Radio," the man said. He held up an 8x10-inch photograph taped to a sheet of hardboard of Radio Man. "Do you mind signing real quick?" "What do you want me to say?" Radio Man asked. "Just Radio Man?" "Yeah," the man said. "Radio Man." Radio Man signed the photograph in big sloppy cursive. The man thanked him and walked away. It was hard to say if he was a grapher or just a fan. A version of this story originally appeared in the New York Times. And on to the Talking Points page. We'll start with the article, Ukraine, a Damaging Intelligence Leak. Who leaked U.S. intelligence about the war in Ukraine, and what was the motive, asked Morgan Chafton in Semaphore. These are questions officials in Washington are trying to answer after the New York Times reported that a trove of more than 100 Pentagon documents had surfaced in an obscure corner of social media. The stolen documents include maps of Ukrainian air defenses and detailed targeting information, as well as the alarming news Ukraine is running out of air defense missiles to repel Russian air attacks. The security breach is the most damaging in decades and could have serious implications for U.S. intelligence efforts. The documents took a circuitous route to the public's eyes, said Jim Garrity in National Review. They were printed out, folded, photographed, and posted on the social media platform Discord over a month ago, then reposted on Twitter, 4chan, and Telegram. Hundreds of intelligence and Pentagon employees could have accessed these papers. Whoever took these photos left a visible bottle of Gorilla Glue on their desk. It's the freshness of these documents that distinguishes this leak from previous ones, said David E. Sanger in the New York Times. Some of the documents are barely a month old. The hints they hold for operations to come makes these disclosures particularly damaging. The intelligence includes conversations among South Korean leaders about pressure from the U.S. to provide 330,000 rounds of ammunition to Ukraine, an indication that the U.S. is spying on its allies. With Ukraine's spring offensive looming, the most troubling information in the leak is that U.S. military officials believe the war is likely heading toward a stalemate that will leave both Vladimir Putin and Ukraine frustrated. But more than the juicy tidbits contained in the material, the most damaging aspect of the story might be the fact of the leak itself, said the Washington Post in an editorial. The real benefit to Russia will be learning the range of U.S. intelligence capabilities that enabled the collection of such information, and to garner hints about how Washington gathered it in the first place. The leak is unlikely to alter the course of the war. Putin remains committed to dragging this out as long as possible, hoping that Western allies will pressure Ukraine to sacrifice territory for peace. No leaks are likely to change that calculus. Abortion, the GOP's Achilles heel. Disgusted voters are punishing Republicans for criminalizing nearly all abortions in red states, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. And the GOP is starting to freak out about its electoral predicament. The whopping 11-point victory of pro-choice Justice Janet Protasiewicz in last week's Supreme Court election in Wisconsin had served as emphatic proof that overturning Roe v. Wade has created a powerful backlash in America's previously complacent pro-choice majority. Since Roe's repeal, pro-choice views prevailed in every abortion-related ballot measure and in midterm elections. The abortion issue helped Democrats stave off the predicted red wave. Polls show that 64% of Americans want abortion to be legal in most circumstances, but the anti-abortion maximalist of the GOP base is spawning draconian restrictions in state after state, including a newly passed 6-week ban in Florida. Even right-wing bomb thrower Ann Coulter now urges moderation. "Please stop pushing strict limits on abortion," she tweeted last week, "or there will be no Republicans left." Wisconsin should be a 5-alarm warning to the Republicans about 2024, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Protasiewicz ran a nakedly political campaign that telegraphed her intent to repeal the state's strict 1849 abortion ban. The result? She dominated cities and came close to taking the once heavily Republican Milwaukee suburbs. In Wisconsin and throughout the country, abortion and Trumpism are turning the suburbs blue, said Matthew Continetti in National Review. Without suburban moderates, the GOP can't win swing states or the White House in 2024. Republicans can still flourish in a post-Roe world, but only with pro-life candidates who can speak about abortion restrictions, with exceptions for rape, incest, and life of the mother, in a non-threatening way. Adding some narrowly worded exceptions to bans hardly equals non-threatening moderation, said Ed Kilgore in New York Magazine. State laws still would make the vast majority of abortions illegal and put women's reproductive decisions in the hands of the legislatures. Moderates don't push 6-week abortion bans like Florida's, which take effect before most women know they're pregnant. If Republicans don't like getting punished by irate voters, they need to swear off prospective federal abortion bans, stop policing women's bodies, and end the forced birth crusade. And a few of the shorter notes. Gun deaths among American children rose 50% between 2019 and 2021, from 1,732 to 2,590, according to a report by the Pew Research Center. Gun deaths among all Americans rose 23% during that period, reaching 48,830, by far the highest number on record. Virginia's rural Buckingham County was left without a functioning voter registrar's office After all four staffers quit due to repeated baseless accusations of voter fraud from Republican officials and the public. Mentally, I couldn't take it anymore, said departing Registrar Lindsay Taylor. Utah's endangered Great Salt Lake has risen 3 feet over the past 3 months due to heavy rains and a series of winter storms that dropped 87 inches of snow on the state. As a record snowpack melts in the coming weeks, the level is expected to grow higher still. The lake remains historically low, but its revival after decades of drought is nothing short of miraculous, said Brigham Young University ecologist Ben Abbott. Officials in U.S., state, and local governments have introduced 563 measures banning the teaching of critical race theory, with 241 put into law, according to a new UCLA study. At least 50 similar measures have been introduced so far this year. And we'll finish out today's program with a quote from Joan Didion, quoted in the Daily Beast. She says, "We are well advised to keep on nodding terms with the people we used to be, whether we find them attractive company or not." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have any comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.